From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, what Detroit's M1 streetcar could mean to public transit in Southeast Michigan.
It might not meet all of the needs itself, since it's just a 3.5-mile stretch, but it will support some of the other efforts and help bring money into the system.
Why millennials are saying no thanks to owning a car.
The millennials have an enormous number of choices where they can put their attention, and cars are really going to the back of the pack.
Plus, domestic abuse survivors, cell phones, and social media.
Your privacy is only as private as your friends and your connections on social network sites.
And we find out why there's little to celebrate in a new look at Michigan's kids and their reading skills. Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Huge numbers, over 800,000 people, packed Cobo Center in Detroit over the past 2 weeks for the North American International Auto Show. Lots of hot cars and new models. But what about actual transportation in the city itself? On today's show, we'll ask what would better public transportation mean for Detroit, a place so deeply rooted in car culture. And then you've no doubt heard that Sunday is Super Bowl Sunday. We're going to talk to the Kalamazoo-based author of Sportuality. She's pushing for a bit more spirituality in everyday athletics and sports. But first, a new report finds the state's poorest children have failed to make up any ground in their reading skills in the past decade. According to the latest Kids Count report, 81% of low-income fourth graders in Michigan are not reading proficiently. And Michigan is among only 6 states to see no improvement in that rate since 2003. Jane Zender Merrill's project director for Kids Count Michigan. Welcome, Jane.
Thank you, Cindy.
Some pretty stark numbers here. When we look at these statistics and realize no improvement since 2003, what do you think? Why is this? Why has there been no improvement in a decade?
I think there are a lot of factors at play. One is we've seen a huge increase in child poverty, so we have a lot more kids and families that are struggling because of our economic situation, and we also have a lot of policies, choices and budget choices that have been made not to provide programming for young children. We've seen a recent turnaround in that where we're investing more in programs for four-year-olds. Last year, $65 million, and the year coming up, we're looking at a recommendation from the governor for another $65 million into our four-year-old preschool program. But what we know from the research is that you have to build on oral learning that takes place in the very earliest years. So we have to have a more comprehensive approach if we want to make changes in these numbers.
Is there any good news at all in this report? Anything we might look at and maybe feel slightly better about?
We didn't get worse. I hate to say that, but this really is a bad news report for Michigan. I mean, we are a state that wants to expand our educated workforce. And this is the first benchmark to have kids, more kids able to read proficiently by the fourth grade. And that we have made no progress over 10 years. And that other states, most other states in the country, have made progress. And we not only see disturbing news about our kids in low-income families, but even our kids in higher-income families aren't doing as well as the national average. 56% of our higher-income fourth graders cannot read proficiently, and that's compared to 49% in the national average.
What do you think is behind that, then, when you look at this at lost ground among the higher-income fourth graders?
Well, clearly we need to be investing more in our reading programs in schools and in our opportunities to give kids access to quality preschool and also to educate parents around what they can do to interact with their kids, building oral language, because that's the basis of reading proficiency. So there's a whole list of interventions that we can put in place to address this issue.
But is it that there's less interest?
Well, we've focused on raising the standards. And we have now focused on four-year-old preschool.
Mm-hmm.
But that's that's the only place. And other areas which could make a difference, like investing more in quality childcare options, we have not done that. And we're not doing a lot around bolstering low-income families through some of the worst recession in the history of our state. So, you know, families are under huge distress, and we're removing the kind of supports that help parents be good parents. You know, we're lowering their stress levels, giving them access to opportunities.
Jane, is there anything that you're seeing happening in Michigan right now that leads you to think that we might see improvement in these numbers next year, if we're talking a year from now?
Well, I think it's promising that the governor and the legislature are putting resources, dollars, into early childhood. We're also talking about the fact that we have so many kids who are not successful readers by the fourth grade. There are some disturbing bills, at least we think they're a little disturbing, about flunking kids who are not proficient readers. But we're not seeing dollars invested in making sure that we have better options for kids, particularly in low-income schools, where we're seeing bigger classes, we're seeing more inexperienced teachers, and we're seeing a lot of school districts that are going into emergency management because of funding issues. So targeting some efforts to reducing class size, to doing some interventions from birth right up through the third grade would be a much more humane approach both for students and parents and schools.
As opposed to flunking youngsters.
As opposed to flunking youngsters or closing schools and punishing teachers, all of which we've been doing for the last 10 years. And we see the results.
Well, it also strikes me that, you know, as you describe, we see backsliding in scores in both children who are low-income and high-income, which leads me to wonder what needs to be happening on the home front as well. I mean, we look at policy and we look at how schools are run and funded and how teachers are teaching, but, you know, mom and dad and the kids, what should be happening on the home front there?
Well, you have to remember that higher income is simply over 185% of the poverty level.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
When we say higher income, the median income in Michigan has dropped dramatically. We've really experienced a huge reversal. So even in what we call higher income families, you may have longer hours, people are working for less money, if they're employed, maybe only one parent in the family is now working full time, or maybe they've accepted a job that pays far less. So there's lots of pressures on even higher income families.
A ripple effect, a huge ripple effect.
Yeah, and that all has an impact on kids.
Jane Zender-Merrill is the project director for Kids Count Michigan. Sobering report and plenty of food for thought in this. Thank you so much, Jane.
Thank you, Cindy, for the opportunity to discuss this important issue.
Super Bowl Sunday is just days away. When you think about the atmosphere at any given sports event, whether it's a Super Bowl or a Red Wings game or even your child's grade school basketball game, chances are the atmosphere is one of fierce competition. Think of the crowd. Think of the chants. You know, beat them. Let's defeat them. But my next guest challenges us to look at sports in another light, in a spiritual light.
Rather than the violence that we all see, the violence and the hate and the anger.
Jean Hess has been the head coach of Kalamazoo College's volleyball team for some 30 years, and she's an associate chaplain. Her book is called Sportuality, Finding Joy in the Games. Jean Hess, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you, Cindy. It's a pleasure to be here.
What would sportuality look like, on the football field, in the volleyball court, on the baseball diamond?
I would say, what would it feel like?
Okay.
You would see the little things, like coaches calling a player out and just giving him a hug, or just talking with a player or helping a player understand something greater. You would see the teachable moments. You would see the times when a professional player acknowledges someone on the other team. So, yeah, There was a time, I think, when Tori Hunter this summer, and there was some great play. Tori, a right fielder, acknowledged the play of another player on the other team, and it was like, yeah, I get it. And he was smiling, and there was obviously something greater than myself going on there. It definitely made it fun to watch.
And what do you think adopting spirituality would mean ultimately to the athletes in our state?
Oh, I think it could exponentially improve relationships. It will let us understand that we are one. I believe so strongly in Michigan. Look at our universities. Look at and even our smaller colleges, all our community colleges. We have an amazing state here. But I do think that adopting spirituality would say we are a bigger community. You know, I'm a member of the Michigan Intercollegiate Athletic Association. While I represent my school, I will cheer like heck for all of our other MIAA schools as they go on to compete in a bigger arena. But I will also commune with those schools around a dinner table or around a committee table or a meeting table for something much greater than ourselves. I think that we can heal a lot of things. I think we can make a lot of things happen. And I don't think it's just about sports. This is about maybe politics, where this us versus them mentality can heal and where we can understand the other and where we actually listen and participate and compete in a positive way with the other, not against the other.
The book is called Sportuality, Finding Joy in the Games. Gene Hess, the head coach of Kalamazoo College's volleyball team. Thank you so much for sharing your insights and talking with us today on Stateside.
Cindy, thank you so much.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Here's a question for you to consider. What important questions are we in the media not asking about Detroit? What impacts of the Detroit bankruptcy have flown under the radar? What about questions about life post-bankruptcy, like just how can Detroit rebuild its neighborhoods and create more high-paying jobs? And what does all of that mean for Michigan as a whole? Well, Michigan Radio is partnering with other media organizations around the state to try and find the answers to those questions. And so welcome to the brand new Detroit Journalism Cooperative. Lester Graham will be digging into the coverage for Michigan Radio, and he's with us now. Hi, Lester.
Hi there.
And joining us is John Bebo, president of the Center for Michigan. Hello, John.
Good afternoon, partner.
Yeah, indeed. And let's start with this idea behind the creation of the Detroit Journalism Cooperative, and that's that there were stories that were really being missed in Detroit?
Well, part of what's most interesting about this collaboration is none of we collaborators actually started this. This was an idea sparked by two national funders in journalism, the Ford Foundation and the Knight Foundation. They actually came to Michigan and brought all of us together, which is a great sign for anybody who cares about current events in the state, but also a great sign for nonprofit news gatherers in our state. This is a considerable outside national investment in the work that all of the partners do. So that's good for us, and it's good for readers and listeners.
And as you heard from these partners and people who are really involved in the city, from people all over Detroit and the neighborhoods, what did they tell you about what they felt was missing in news coverage in Detroit?
Well, I think Lester can speak to this, too, because we've begun a series of listening sessions with the diverse Detroiters. There are so many issues that can be covered more deeply, and no disrespect intended to the current media that's working very hard to do so now. It's just the media landscape has changed so much that with a story this complex, there's no way that the current newsroom structures could completely cover this story on
right.
its own.
There are literally hundreds of stories that could be covered, and we're just trying to add to the mix.
For both of you, why are these stories so important to tell in your mind, Lester?
One of the things that is a great concern to me is bankruptcy for the city of Detroit is bankruptcy for a corporate entity. It happens to be that all the Detroit residents own it. But, you know, bankruptcy of the city itself has nothing to do or little to do with the day-to-day lives of the people. So after bankruptcy is finished and the city's debts are, you know, dealt with, the question is the city sustainable? How are they going to be able to fund it in the future? How's that going to happen? And that's one of the things I'm really interested in finding out. You know, life goes on, whether the city's in bankruptcy or not. Mm-hmm. After it's finished, what will life look like? What can they depend on in city services? But more importantly, where do we go here as a community, not as a city corporate entity?
Part of what we're trying to show is that they matter to all of the people of Michigan. Some of the first stories that we've done in this project, we looked at a term that on its face sounds pretty boring. It's called legacy costs. It's what we all owe for pension and health care obligations for public employees. That's part of what drove the city of Detroit, the corporate entity, as Lester calls it, into bankruptcy. But indeed, it's actually a huge problem in communities from Kalkaska to Kalamazoo and everywhere else in the state. And we wanted to point that out as the first series of stories we did in this project to show that no matter where you live in Michigan, the Detroit bankruptcy does matter to you, because the precedents that will be set in this legal case may trickle down to your very own local community. And the structural financial troubles that exist in Detroit actually do indeed exist in many other places across the state. So that's part of why it matters so much to us personally.
Celeste, you're going to be kicking off the coverage for Michigan Radio this week. What can we expect to hear from you?
Well, my first piece is going to be about the prosperity of the residents of the city. You know, if you can't pay income tax because you don't have a job, if you're not paying property tax because you don't have a job, if you're renting instead of buying a house and contributing to the neighborhood, that's going to have an impact on the city. So Detroit won't become a sustainable city. It won't become prosperous if that prosperity is not shared among the residents first. So I think to build up the city, you have to build up the workforce, and that's what I'm going to be looking at.
And that's it sounds like that's the building block. Is that why you chose this story first?
I think so. You know, when you look at Detroit workers, those people who are left within the city, in the 1970s, of the black men who were working in the 1970s, most of them were working in the automotive industry. Today, when you look at the black men in the city of Detroit, most of them are working in the fast food industry. They're also working for 50% or less of the pay that they were making on average in the 1970s. That's really important to look at. You know, why don't we have jobs for them? Most of them were done away with because of automation and so forth. So what are we going to do now? And we're starting to look at some of the places where they are doing new things.
John, you touched on this in your comments a bit ago about the legacy costs, but I'd like your thoughts even more on expanding this disconnect that when we're telling the story of Detroit, it often feels like we hear the message sometimes that Detroit just does not matter to the rest of the state. How is it you hope this project will change that narrative?
Well, I think we have to continue to illustrate that Detroit's problems exist in other communities as well, and bring that message home to people. I think for reasons both legitimate and illegitimate, there's a lot of distrust between Detroiters and outstaters, and outstaters and Detroiters. And we have to show what life is like on the ground in the city, and also connect that to the lives of people around the state. And I think we're going to do that. And I think Lester's story out of the gate is just a tremendous example of some great reporting. And I think it twins nicely with some of the work that Bridge is going to introduce this week. Mayor Duggan has come out of the gate and said, look, I want you to measure me on some benchmarks. And this is very similar to what he did at the DMC in his marketing campaigns about, you know, you can get into our emergency rooms and get treated fast. He's trying to bring that approach to the much more complex world of city government. It's going to be fascinating to watch.
You know, one thing I wanted to point out that John has pointed out, this really is a Michigan problem. I mean, as Detroit goes, so will much of Michigan, because it is our largest city. The other thing is, it's easy to boil this down to a political argument that Republicans love to say, look, this is how Democrats run a city. You know, it's far, far more complicated than that. It's far deeper than that. And the fact is, the state has some of the same exact problems as Detroit. The state has a huge pension deficit. The state has other tools it can use, like, oh, I don't know, taking a larger share of the revenue sharing money and using it to wipe out debt or problem deficits for the state at the expense of the cities. And that's something all cities are paying for, and something that's hit Detroit particularly hard because it had such a large share of revenue sharing. There are all these stories that are out there. It's never as simple as some people would like you to think. You know, it's corruption and Democrats. Yeah, no, that's just doesn't hold water when you get down to looking at the numbers.
It's an interesting preview of what we can come to look forward to from the Detroit Journalism Cooperative. Lester Graham, investigative reporter for Michigan Radio, and John Bebo, director at the Center for Michigan. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thrilled to be with you. Thanks.
Support for the Detroit Journalism Cooperative comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation and the Ford Foundation. And you can listen to the first of Lester Graham's reports right here on Michigan Radio on Thursday. Catch his story during Morning Edition and All Things Considered. And we'll be talking a lot with Lester and other members of the Detroit Journalism Cooperative right here on Stateside. And of course, we love talking with you. What stories are you especially interested in right now? Is it something going on in Detroit, perhaps to do with the bankruptcy, or maybe something from the UP is on your mind? No matter where it is, let us know. You can find us on Facebook or tweet us at Stateside Radio, and you can find us online at MichiganRadio.org. Just click on the link that says Stateside. Domestic violence, it's something that reaches every single corner of American life. The National Coalition Against Domestic Violence tells us that 85% of the people who suffer violence at the hands of an intimate partner are women. One in every four women will experience domestic violence in her lifetime. That's 1.3 million American women each and every year. And most of these women will have mobile phones, computers, Facebook pages, and online presence. The presence of these information communication technologies, ICTs, poses ever-growing challenges to a survivor who's trying to stay well away from an abusive partner. Just how do these technologies influence interpersonal violence? Jill Diamond is a computer science graduate from the University of Michigan. After she earned her PhD at Georgia Tech, she came back to Michigan to focus her efforts on what she calls human-centered computing. That includes forming a worker-owned technology cooperative called Sassafras Tech Collective. They help social justice groups, nonprofits, artists, and others with web and app design and development. Welcome, Jill.
Thanks so much for having me, Cynthia.
So is it safe to say information communication technologies could enable more domestic violence?
Well, I think it's just another channel that's available for access for abusers to survivors of domestic violence to reach them. To start with, without technology, there's just an enormous web that survivors can get caught in that makes it really hard to escape abusers from financial reasons, children. But technology becomes another piece in that web. And if you think about it, we all have mobile phones on us now. Mm-hmm. It didn't used to be the case. Now we actually have this part that can enable more communication at all times of day.
Can you give us, based on what you've seen and the work you've done, what are some of the examples of ways the technology can hinder a woman who's trying to hide her presence from an abuser once a relationship is over?
One of the things I saw in my research is that there was a big concern about location-based technologies and services. Just a not understanding of how they worked, and sometimes those location services were used to stalk and find out where survivors were. And there's just a big fear about not understanding how to control these services and how to limit their and make private their location. So at one point, one of my research participants, one of the survivors I talked to, she said she found out she had GPS on her phone and she just threw the phone out the window.
And they try a lot of different strategies, don't they, the survivors, to be able to stay in touch, keep a mobile phone, but also hopefully keep the abuser from finding them?
Yeah, they were very resilient. You know, they came up with some impressive tactics from getting a new phone, registering under aliases, having kind of complicated ways to talk to family members for having them calling them back. And they're really resilient, but it just seemed like there could have been more thought into the design of these technologies to help them manage their privacy and to make it easier, because it was just another thing that that these survivors had to deal with.
So you're saying technology has not really embraced someone who is trying to avoid someone.
That's right. I mean, social technologies, it's really hard to model social life. It has to go beyond this binary notion of friend or not friend to really mirror the complicated social lives that we have. Another interesting issue is not only just women, but other kinds of intimate partner violence, like LGBTQ communities. They have to manage information such as their sexual orientation or gender identities. And that just becomes more information, more fodder for abusers to try to control survivors.
And we were talking all here, and it hit us, as we were saying, it just takes a few mouse clicks, and you've got more information than we could ever imagine. Is there really a way for a survivor to ever feel safe when this is the way it is? Click, 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 I've got your home address?
It's really hard to feel safe, because some of the properties of the internet is that the information is persistent. It doesn't go away. It's really hard to have this notion of ephemerality, that information will just fade. So it is hard to feel safe, but at the same time, it's not as though survivors can just stop using technology. Mm-hmm. They need it to build a new life, to build new contacts, find a job.
Apply for benefits.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I did see a chilling effect among women. They were so hesitant to use technology, but they knew that they needed to. So they just had to kind of deal with it.
Well, what kind of advice and what kind of strategies can you offer to people who are trying to kind of stay hidden from an abuser? Are there particular do's and don'ts?
I would say that there are some variety of services to block communications. It used to be that it was really hard to block SMSs and phone calls on your mobile phone, mm-hmm. because there was an additional cost, and sometimes it didn't work. There are some apps now that you can download to block them, but they don't always work. So I would recommend looking at the National Network to End Domestic Violence. They have some great safe technology tips, including all the complicated settings for different social network sites and how to really evaluate your network, because your privacy is only as private as your friends and your connections and social network sites. So bringing awareness to those contacts that what they share about you can also affect, you know, your privacy.
And to put the ball in the court of cell phone carriers and government and law enforcement and Facebook and the network of providers of this content, what needs to be done on that end? It sounds like there needs to be kind of an adjustment or a rethinking of how these services are offered and what's provided.
Sure. There's been, I believe last year there was a big change.org petition petitioning Verizon Wireless and other carriers to let domestic violence survivors end their contract early, because oftentimes they were bound up in this family contract where they would then have to pay hundreds of dollars in order to end their phone contract.
That's right.
So they've made a lot of progress in that. The campaign was successful. But it's not clear that it's so easy to do. And this notion of, again, that's reflected in technology use and the cell phone side, is this notion of a family package that, you know, that most of the limits are and controls are based on parents protecting their children.
Correct.
So we need to also think about what are controls for personal safety, and what can phone certain internet service providers, what can cell phone providers provide for preventing violence and harassment.
So the website, again, the group that has the good information that can help, especially the idea of helping you by figuring out Facebook or Instagram or Twitter or any of these to help figure out how to set your security settings, and that site again?
It's a national network to end domestic violence.
All right. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was Dr. Jill Diamond with Sassafras Tech Collective talking about how technologies indeed influence interpersonal violence. And we have put a link for you to the National Network to End Domestic Violence. You can find it on the website, michiganradio.org. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. If you've spent time in Chicago or New York or San Francisco or Washington, you know the value of a good public transportation system, something that has been woefully lacking in Southeast Michigan. But there are hopeful signs. The M1 rail along Woodward in Detroit, talk of an Ann Arbor to Detroit commuter line, planned improvements on the Pontiac to Chicago Amtrak line. Couple this with the fact that according to the University of Michigan's Transportation Research Institute, 26% of households in Detroit do not have a car. That leads to the question, what would better public transit options mean to Detroit, a city so deeply rooted in car culture? We're joined now by Richard Murphy. He's the program's director of the Michigan Suburbs Alliance, and he's just wrapped up a one-year term on Southeast Michigan's Regional Transit Authority Board. Welcome.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Did it all surprise you to hear that a quarter of all households in the Motor City don't have a car?
I don't think that's terribly surprising, both between the younger households moving into downtown and midtown that might choose to not have a car or be college students and live on campus, or the households that can't afford to have a car and are carless because they don't have a choice in the matter. Those are two very different demographics and very different needs that we need to be aware of and take care of.
And what about looking out of Detroit and looking at Southeast Michigan? If we had a really good public transit system, mm-hmm. how high do you think that figure might go?
I mean, it's hard to say a percent, but you have places like Ann Arbor, Ypsilanti, Ferndale, Birmingham, Royal Oak along the Woodward corridor where, you know, there already are a lot of people who live with, you know, one car for multiple adults or without a car and get around by transit or biking or walking preferentially.
So that could definitely go up if there was that.
Right. That's even without a good regional transit system.
I want to talk a little, Richard, about your experience on the Southeast Michigan Regional Transit Authority Board. What was that year like for you? How much cooperation did you see?
Well, I came into it as an advocate who had worked on the legislation to create the RTA. One of the things that worked well so far is the Providers Advisory Committee, the table that the RTA has where all of the transit providers come together and have started talking about how do they better work together, what are the opportunities that they can identify with their existing resources or that they might be able to work on with new resources coming into the system. So things like right now they're talking about how do we get a single fare card system for all of the transit agencies in Metro Detroit so that rather than a separate fare card mm-hmm. for each place that you might go, someone like me who travels across the region for work might only have to carry one card that works on every transit system. And you know, once we get the commuter rail or the M1 streetcar up and running, can transfer from one to the other without any effort at all.
The way we see in Chicago.
Exactly, or San Francisco
yes.
or other. Yeah.
But with what we have as the board now, as it exists now, do we have, as a region, do we have what it takes to make that viable public transit system happen?
Well, we have the start of it. Okay. I think we certainly see a lot of interest and political support for the RTA that led to its actual establishment. You know, the things we do lack are funding in order to create it, as well as a lot of the planning work to get from the very high-level conceptual idea of a regional transit system to something that's actually on the ground that you can get on and ride. So we do have a number of years' worth of work in the technical planning and engineering and funding and building before some of this really becomes reality.
I'm speaking with Richard Murphy, who recently wrapped up a one-year term on Southeast Michigan's RTA, Regional Transit Authority Board. How did serving on that board, Richard, help shape your perception of Detroit's car culture?
Well, I came into this with a lot of background in transportation planning and looking at biking and walking and transit and other things beyond the car. Certainly the perception of car culture is something that we have to address and recognize as we're working to improve transit. I don't know that the board term itself shaped my perspective. so much as all of the initiatives that are going on in the region that are engaging with the board, okay. whether it's the streetcar effort downtown that is really being driven by private actors until the RTA is in a place to pick it up and take ownership of it, or the rapid transit system, the study on Woodward looking all the way from downtown Detroit all the way up to Pontiac that was initiated by the suburban communities in Oakland County who said, you know, we see what's happening in downtown Detroit mm-hmm. and we want transit too. How do we make that happen? So there are a lot of these pieces that are out there that I get to see and be a part of that I think once the RTA has gone through its startup phase and is in a position to start tying together all the pieces, we will be able to see a system emerge out of a lot of these efforts.
I'd like to talk a little about the M1 and the idea mm-hmm. that there are critics who are saying, you know, why are we spending money on the M1 rail to get you from Detroit to Midtown when the bus service is so terrible, and that money ought to go to repairing buses and adding routes. What do you say to that?
Well, yeah, as we mentioned at the beginning, there are a lot of different needs here. Mm-hmm. And any piece of the transit system is going to address one piece of those needs.
And finite dollars, we should say.
Right, and finite dollars, yeah. too. And those dollars come from a number of different sources. So the M1 streetcar is meant to address the need of how do we circulate people within the downtown? How do we get people from their hotel to the DIA or to a concert or from where they've parked to the sports stadium
okay.
for a game or to a restaurant? Or if somebody's coming in on the Ann Arbor to Detroit commuter rail at some point in the future, how do we get them to their actual job rather than just dropping them off at the Amtrak station mm-hmm. at Grand Boulevard? So that's a need that the private backers of the M1 streetcar identified and stepped in to work on filling. There are definitely other needs that we also have to work on that the DDOT bus system and access for neighborhood residents to the downtown or to other locations outside of downtown or around the region are still big issues. There are definitely finite dollars, but there are also funds that have already been granted to address things like broken buses or broken fare boxes so that we can get those pieces working well too. So it might not meet all of the needs itself since it's just a 3.5 mile stretch, but it will support some of the other efforts and help bring money into the system as well as help build attention and energy for transit. So people become aware of, oh, this is visible, this is real, this is how it could work. Mm-hmm. We need to invest in more of this.
Richard Murphy is with the Michigan Suburbs Alliance, and he recently wrapped up a term serving on Southeast Michigan's Regional Transit Authority Board. Richard, thank you so much for talking with us.
Yeah, thank you.
And more interesting statistics from U of M's Transportation Research Institute. It finds that from coast to coast, more and more of us are making do without a car or truck. And it seems much of that is driven by the way younger Americans look at cars. We're joined by Bridge magazine writer Rick Hagland, who recently explored these questions in a piece entitled, As Detroit Auto Show Revs, America Cools to Car Culture. And we're joined by writer Mickey Maynard, co-founder of Curbing Cars. It's a website that tracks changing attitudes towards transportation. She's also a former Detroit bureau chief for the New York Times. Rick, I'll start with you. What did you hear as you researched your story? Is America's love affair with cars cooling off, or is this a temporary slump as we try to shake off the Great Recession?
Well, there is a good debate about that. There are a lot of statistics that seem to indicate that people of all ages are driving less overall. The University of Michigan's Transportation Research Institute has done a lot of work in this area, and they've found that people are driving less. The ownership rates per household per driver are going down. So, you know, there seems to be a trend of less driving and a little less interest in automobiles. Others, particularly the auto companies, will say that this is basically a result of the very steep recession that we had that is keeping young people out of the new car market at the rates that they were before the recession. And that one of the reasons for that is that this young millennial generation of roughly 18 to 30 or 31-year-olds has not benefited from the recovery to the extent that older buyers have.
Mickey, you and I have talked about this on Stateside, the fact that, you know, as a baby boomer, I couldn't get into the Secretary of State office to take my driving test fast enough. I think I hauled my parents in on my 16th birthday to do it. And my daughter didn't go for hers for 6 months until after she turned 16. And that was really because I twisted her arm and kind of made her. So what is going on here, do you think?
Well, there's a new study that I just wrote about for Forbes magazine, which looks at what younger people, millennials, so people who were born after about the early 1980s, really feel about cars. And one of the things that these people said was, you can have my car, don't take my phone. This is a generation that's much more focused on mobile devices. And they've actually said that they use mobile devices, so your phone, your laptop, your tablet, as a reason to get together with people that doesn't require driving. So they can text, they can go on Skype, they can do a Google Hangout, they can see their friends, they just don't have to be with their friends. And so when you don't have that physical need to be with someone, you can get along a little bit less without a car.
So we're really looking at a real shift in attitudes.
Right. So I think the economy is a big part of it because it's very expensive. You know, it costs over about $500 a month to own a vehicle if you include everything from what you pay for insurance to gas to oil to repairs to parking if you have to pay for parking, and then obviously your car payment. But if you look at younger people, first of all, they never got into that mindset. So I think there's an attitudinal issue here as much as an economic issue. You have people that just never fell in love with automobiles. You know, people who are in the baby boom generation and even in Gen X, they fell in love with cars because that was something that they could fall in love with. It was one of the choices that they had. Now the millennials have an enormous number of choices where they can put their attention, and cars are really going to the back of the pack.
That was writer Mickey Maynard, who is co-founder of Curbing Cars. This website chronicles changing attitudes towards transportation. And she's joined by Bridge Magazine writer Rick Haglund, who recently explored the question, are we driving less and what has changed in the way Americans are looking at cars? He wrote a piece for Bridge recently. And I was talking with auto analyst Michelle Krebs recently about this idea of more young people deciding they can do fine without a car. And in essence, she pushed back in a pretty big way and said she doesn't buy this at all. And she figures once these millennials get themselves set in their jobs and get launched and marry or form a domestic partnership, that they're going to move to the suburbs and they are going to want a car. And you kind of heard that, didn't you, Rick, from somebody from Ford?
Yes. I mean, and that's basically the way the auto companies see it, is that that the millennials will end up being, you know, pretty much like their parents were. Once they set up households, they have children, they're going to move to the suburbs and they're going to need a car. And certainly a lot of them are going to do that. But when you look at some of the forecasts for new car sales in the future, a number of analysts, including the Center for Automotive Research in Ann Arbor, are basically saying that we may never get back to 17 million, selling 17 million cars and trucks again the way we did a decade or so ago. So obviously, you know, household formation is going to increase in the future, but you know, if sales are not going to go up commensurate with that, you know, it looks like, you know, the millennial buying patterns are going to be part of that trend that's going to keep sales suppressed a bit.
There's an interesting study from McGill University in Montreal that actually looks at millennials and their use of public transportation. And it shows that the longer you use public transportation before you start to get into car buying is a lost opportunity for the automakers. So if you think about the boomer generation, people started to buy new cars out of college. So say age 22, 23, 24. Some of these millennials are not buying their first new car until they're in their 30s. That would mean that the car industry is losing, you know, about 10 to 12 years of car sales to these people. So I absolutely believe that millennials will eventually start buying more cars, but there's going to be maybe one or two chances to get them into automobiles that the car companies will miss. So what happens when someone has put off car buying? Well, we've seen what's happened in our society when people get put off getting married and put off having kids. Your lifestyle is just different.
So what does this mean for automakers? How should their marketing messages be adjusted, or can they be?
Well, from my view, and I'd love to hear what Rick has to say, I think they have to realize that cars are now part of a portfolio. They're part of an idea that you walk when you can, use public transportation when it's available, maybe ride your bike in decent weather, not this kind of weather. Use a car when you need a car. And this whole idea of selling cars has always been based on what they call the sizzle, not the steak. And now I really think they do need to think about the steak. And maybe it's not a 12-ounce porterhouse, but a 6-ounce filet instead.
And the new car industry has really gone more and more upscale. They're chasing a smaller segment of buyers, a wealthier segment. You know, there's some data out there that's indicated that the proportion of millennials that are buying luxury cars has gone up a bit, although the definition of luxury has been adjusted downward a little bit as well. But the way the industry is going, you know, they may not really be looking at that mass market anymore, that they're looking at people of wealth regardless of what age they are.
I think it's absolutely true what Rick just said. They don't need millennials right now to buy a whole bunch of small cars if they can get older consumers to spend more on pickup trucks, on luxury cars, on some of the regular car models that have a lot of technology loaded into them. So at the moment, it isn't going to hurt them, and profitability is certainly holding up because the average price of a car is now around $33,000. So for the moment, this is not an issue for the car makers, but you know, this has never been an industry that has a long-term view, and I'm tending to take the long-term view and say, you know, some of these millennials will eventually hit 40, and they may not have bought a car, and then the auto industry has to worry about people who are sort of middle-aged not buying cars. And in the meantime, as boomers sell their big houses and get rid of their fleets of cars and move into the city, you know, you lose some of the boomer buyers, the empty nesters as well. So if I were a car company, I would be looking at every single aspect of this and trying to figure out, okay, we can't just sell cars the way we used to. Now how do we sell cars?
That was writer Mickey Maynard, her website, co-founder of Curbing Cars, a website that actually tracks changing attitudes towards transportation. She was also joined by Bridge Magazine writer Rick Hagland. As always, it's a pleasure talking to both of you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Chris Haddle, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, and Claire Tanisketter. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.